like they were going a little too far, for especially for my young, angsty, teenage rocker mentality at the time.
Totally. And we were like, that was when MTV actually showed videos all the time. And that was what we were getting inundated. Like, it really was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Like, that was all a total, well, I mean, maybe not the drugs for everybody, but like, sex and rock and roll were huge. And I remember I was a young, not even maybe teenage boy when MTV came out. And, you know, being the son of a pastor, we were absolutely not allowed to watch that. And we had to go to our friends' houses and beg them to turn on MTV. Bienvenue, which is welcome in French. Welcome to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. My name is Tim Wheaton. I am the podcast host and the creator of Daddy Unscripted. Yes, I welcome you in a different language every episode. And I just realized, shockingly, that I've never done French. I'm not sure how that's happened, but I haven't. So here we are today with a great episode with Michael Shields, or Mike Shields. I never asked him what he went by, and I've heard some people call him Mikey. So I'm assuming you can go with any version of that. I'm not sure if you can go as far as like Mikhail or Mikhail or anything like that. But Mike Shields is an awesome guy who is part of the Osiris Podcast Network with myself. And the Daddy Unscripted podcast. He's actually involved with three different Osiris podcasts, which is probably the world record so far. He is the creator of the Across the Margin podcast. He is part of the Godween Evan podcast, which if you listen to my episode with comedian Evan Kaufman, you got to hear about some of that. And he also is part of the Welcome to the Party Pal podcast, which is also really cool and different. I love that podcast too. So let me have a little moment of your time to have somebody tell you a little bit more about the Osiris Podcast Network. Osiris.
This podcast is in the loop, the Legion of Osiris Podcasts. What does that mean? Osiris is a community of great music and culture podcasts. If you like this one, go check out others at osirispod.com and get in the loop. Osiris is partnered with Relics Magazine at relics.com.
Okay, and there it is. So, without taking too much more of your time with this intro, let's get right to my episode. And I didn't do like a formal greeting or anything, so this is going to really hit the ground running, like Indiana Jones on a horse jumping onto a car, or something like that. Like, it's really just hitting the ground running. So here is my conversation with Mike Shields.
Your father was a pastor, and that affected, you know, kind of what you can intake. My parents are pretty religious themselves, and for some reason, they couldn't care less about... My father's he's a pastor at his church down there in Orlando. He doesn't mess around with this type of stuff, but for some reason he just didn't care. Like, I talk about it on Welcome to the Party Pal from time to time. Like, R-rated movies were not a thing at an early age. MTV, it was all good. I think they were just happy I was distracted and not causing trouble or something, but.
Yeah.
They were not censoring what I was taking in, and I'd like to go ahead and thank them for that. But I will always give my parents a lot of credit, because I mean, I guess, you know, I am kind of like the typical black sheep, if you will. I mean, and they are very religious. Our politics don't jive so much, but they have always been so supportive, and they've always just, you know, kind of, there's almost not just supportive, but I could see and almost sense a sort of pride sometimes in that difference, meaning that they would see somebody that's, you know, kind of got these thoughts of his own and these passions of his own. And although they're probably, you know, inside boiling at some of them and whatnot, sometimes I can really feel a sense of pride that, like, you know, we raised one of ours is out there on his own doing this thing, but he strongly believes in these ideas, and that's cool. He's ours still, you know. We love him regardless, you know, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, that I'm sure since your dad was in or is in the position he's in, you probably heard the term unconditional love.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And it's
my parents use that a lot on me.
Do they really? Yes.
They did when I was a kid. As one of the black sheep in my family, I heard a lot of, we love you unconditionally.
Yes, exactly. It was just not straight love. They had to make sure they noted that this is unconditional. This is love because we have to.
Right, yeah.
Or because it just happens that way, which is a beautiful thing. Yeah, I mean, yeah. When you do have these children, they are, I guess, one of the things I learned when I first had a daughter is, as watching them grow, I didn't fully understand how unique they would be. I don't know if that sounds crazy. I just didn't understand how you started seeing it early on with my daughter, and I'm sure everyone does, when you realize, yes, you know, they're learning things from you, but just right off the bat, they're their complete own being. Mm-hmm. And that is just, that's one of those beautiful first moments you have with a child. And you're just like, there's this individual thing that is, I guess, looks like the sum of the parts of its parents, but they're their own.
Right. It's yeah. Wild. They're kind of your little mini me's, but they also
are their mini them's.
Yeah. They have their own free will, and darn it, they're going to use it. I think I said darn it right there.
Darn it.
It was a mix. I couldn't decide between damn it and darn it. I went with darn it.
And just like your father invented sling, you just invented a new word.
Yep. Woohoo. So let's kick it back, because we've been
all over the place.
Really introduce you, like do any of that kind of stuff. Let's go back to your dad, even a little bit to your mom there, to talk about all of the siblings. But what year was your, or even time frame, was your dad born? What was his sibling story? And if it makes sense, like anything about his dad possibly.
Yeah, well, he was he's from the New Haven area, so he was kind of a product of the 60s, I would say. He was, you know, he was of age to go to Vietnam. One thing we're always very thankful for, he had a messed up knee.
It's okay, I put the little red E on this.
Oh, great.
For all,
oh, good
people.
I got a potty mouth, man.
Are you saying that because of my dharmit? Yeah, that I said
exactly. I need to utilize words like dharmit. But he had a messed up knee that kept him out of Vietnam, which we always, you know, thank for us being here. Yeah. Being here. But his father was military. He was in the Navy, and I think he hit the bottle pretty hard. My dad does not drink and stays far away from it, and he won't really talk about it much. But everything that, you know, us siblings get a word about is that it was pretty hard on him, his father's issues with that growing up. He came back, he was in the Korean War, and, you know, a lot of things could explain for what he was dealing with at that. But he was the oldest sibling. He's had two younger kids, my aunt and my uncle. And I think he took a lot of that on, and kind of, and they were not wealthy. I'll go so far to say they're pretty impoverished growing up in New Haven. And I think that really built his character and who he became. And he ended up working, going to UConn and becoming a businessman. But he studied engineering, but then went into business and made quite a success of himself. You know, it's cliche, but he's no doubt a self-made man who took, I think, found a lot of solace in religion, as we discussed, and then in his future wife, my mom, Nancy, he kept it straight and narrow, and really was purposeful and kind of getting it as right as he could, because he didn't have it as right as he could, and that's something I'm proud of, grateful for. You know, it's like I said, the apple has, with me, fallen far from the tree in many different ways, but I couldn't respect you know, the way he did things more.
Yeah.
And the reasons behind that. So he met my mother at UConn, and she it's wild because she did have the 9 siblings, this big family from New England, but that whole family she's from, they're pretty amazing. They all are tight. They, a credit to my grandparents on that side of the family. It's just this amazing group of, upper middle class New England people who, you know, they've all done really well for themselves, but they've all, I always think about, this letter my, grandfather wrote to the 9 of the kids right before he passed. And I actually have a copy of it. I made my mother make a copy of it. And he asked them all, he made a point to, you know, he realized that as all the families are growing and some are doing better than others. And he's just like, do not let jealousy or the different things you all go through, each family will go through different things. Don't get caught up in any sort of competition or, you know, make sure to focus on, you know, the bonds that tie, not the things that would tear us apart. And the foresight that he had to make sure he let them know before he was gone that there are going to be these, you know, reasons to kind of simple reasons, dumb reasons to get aggravated with each other. She's like, don't let that happen, which was always cool. So yeah, I've been pretty lucky with the parents situation. They have through all my wild high school years where I definitely pushed back towards independence and fell in love with bands and maybe traveled with said bands and whatever. They've stuck with me through the whole thing, and they've been pretty awesome. So I count blessings there, to say the least.
So where were you born and where did you grow up?
I grew up in Connecticut. So it was my father's job was for Aetna. It's an insurance company. Hartford is the insurance capital of the world, or was at some point. And so it was right outside of Hartford. It was called Glastonbury. I lived there through high school, halfway through high school. This is where things get really angsty for me, because my older two siblings, you know, they went through high school, went to college, went to some New England college. And then it was me and my younger brother. Around halfway through high school, my father gets fired from Aetna, kind of blindsided. And you know how it is. I'm 16. Things are going. I'm on the up and up. Like it's just having fun in high school. I've been with the same group of friends forever. And all of a sudden, he's, you know, sitting me and my little brother down, and he's like, we're either moving to Virginia or Texas. And
oh gosh.
And yeah. And it's, I mean, as privileged a problem as it could be, this was like a nightmare for me. I'm like, this is like, yeah, really, yeah. I think my little brother, to his credit, and he's always been more mature than me, was kind of like, he was a little younger. So he was around 8th grade, about to start high school. He's like, yeah, wherever I start high school, it's a new beginning anyways. I'm getting ripped. In my mind, I'm getting ripped from the middle of like my experience, what I thought was owed to me. My high school experience is owed to me. And so I think I made a scene, definitely not Texas, whatever. And we ended up in Northern Virginia. And that was a hard year for me. That was I know what it's like to sit at a lunch table for like 4 months by myself. And people were great to me, and I eventually made some of my best friends in my life at that high school and everything. But at first, when you end up in a situation like that, you do walk into established cliques. Everything's kind of rolling, as things were rolling with me back in Connecticut. So I understand why I was. And it actually, kind of for a laugh, it was a Catholic high school, but it was a real druggy scene. So I come in, and I got my kind of like rock and roll fish mentality going on. There were some people there who thought I might have been a narc. You know, because I'm like a new kid coming in and just like knows. You know, I know all about like bathtub gins and like all these wild like whatever like things.
I've rehearsed my play well.
And so yeah, whatever. Yeah. It was a tough transition. And I know I was not a good son during that period, but I was having a hard time. But I did get to circle around when I kind of came to, and, you know, I ended up going to college that I loved in Virginia. That would have never happened if I didn't move down to Virginia. I went to Virginia Tech. I loved it down there in Blacksburg, Virginia. So many of my friends, as I mentioned, that are lifelong friends came from that high school in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. I did have the opportunity to, years later on, kind of sit my parents down and be like, I'm sorry. You know, you have to understand that was hard on me. I didn't know what was going on. But B, thank you, because that was actually one of the best things to happen to me in my life. It was getting me out of a kind of like a normal routine. It challenged me. It helped me, find ways to meet new people. It just kind of opened up my world. I remember when I went to college 2 years later, a lot of people, that was their first experience being away and meeting new people. I was like, this is a breeze. Like,
yeah, this is easy.
I just did this. Like, I'm like, where's everyone at? Like my transition to college couldn't have been more delightful. And it was definitely because of that. So, you know, when people ask me where I'm from, I actually have a hard time with that answer. Cause like, yes, the answer is Connecticut, but, I kind of came to, and my formative years were without a doubt in, Virginia. So I don't know exactly, what that answer is.
But that's so cool that it ended up being that when it was, I can only imagine like at that age, because for me too, and I hadn't been tight with my friends at school only since like seventh grade, because I went to a different school at that point that was in a completely different city and everything. But I can imagine like my parents ripping me out of that core that I was in. And for almost any 16 year old, like that is a massive, massive freak show of a change. Like, what are you doing to me?
No. Yeah. You take it personal. You're like, that's the thing. The lack of foresight of someone at that age, I couldn't see what this was doing. I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I was so adamant about not making this move happen. I was such a dick that my dad, and I'm not going to apologize, but I deserve that. I was such a dick.
That's okay.
That for like the first 3 months of when he did get his job in Northern Virginia, he's like, all right, I'm going to see, you know, what happens here. I'm going to give it a go. So he was flying down during the week away from the wife that he loved and the kids that he loved, and spending the week there and coming back on the weekends just to like kind of appease me for a minute or just, and also get a feel of the job and see, making sure it was working. But he was doing that mostly for me. And then after a while, he was just like, this is not working. And, you know, but he did, he was trying to find a way to make it work for my, you know,
easier for you. And that's crazy.
Yeah.
It is crazy. Like, you know, every once in a while I have that conversation with my wife about our kids who are 6 and 10, and that reminder of they don't fully grasp what they are wanting us to do for them or what they are quote unquote demanding of us. We need to remember, like, you got to flex your muscle every once in a while and be the parent. And for a 16-year-old to be able to see, and no slight on you, I think this is
absolutely
par for the course for a human brain that is at that point of development, to see the level of selfishness of, sorry, dad, you just lost your job, but are you insane? You think you're moving me out of my circle of friends? You're crazy.
Yeah, just for social reasons. I was worried about my whole life coming apart, and his, you know, career was coming apart. It's funny, he did end up going down to work for Freddie Mac. And I don't know if you know anything about kind of the fallout of economic things that occurred, but Freddie Mac was kind of at the heart of some of the things.
Oh, yeah.
It was wild to hear, because like during some of the more trying times, you know, he would be lamenting to his kids who don't care about how they were asking him to, you know, make loans he shouldn't. Or I think I would more overhear him talking to my mom at the table about, like, you know, I don't know what's happening here, but this this isn't going so well.
Yeah.
Which
yeah, it's like the kids of parents that were involved in Watergate. Like you're just sitting there having a nice dinner and they're like, I'm not really sure if this is on the up and up or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's over your head, but you can feel the seriousness of it. You can feel it. You're like you could see it, like you could see the forehead rub, I need to go. For the sake of the food on this table here, I need to go to work tomorrow. But at work tomorrow, they are not allowing me, but asking me to do things that aren't so hot. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The difference of I talk about this a lot with people as well. Like what we now realize as we get older of things that we saw, heard, experienced as kids that just went over our heads. Like,
yeah,
I've had this conversation, you know, with my wife about our kids who are in the room, and you know, I think we are semi-conservative with our kids. We just are trying to not, you know, catapult them into everything all at once. And
sure.
I try to not be as heavy-handed, and I don't feel like we're really restricting them at this point yet.
Okay.
I know that day will come.
Yeah.
But
not even the 10-year-old?
No, not really. She's very, I think she's just kind of like grasped where we are with stuff. And so fortunately at this point, she starts middle school next year. So I told my wife this weekend, actually, I said, we're getting closer and closer to the sex talk. Like,
yep.
At least to some extent, like we don't need to, I don't know what the 80s version of sex video of Red Pavement would be, Red Asphalt.
Yep.
It's probably a horrible segue for people who have no idea what that means.
Google it.
Red Asphalt. It was Red Asphalt, right?
Yep. I believe it was.
That's like the worst. Hey, I'm going to talk to you about a sex video for kids, and I'm going to mention the words Red Asphalt. Probably not a great job on my part, but Red Asphalt was the scared straight video that they would show you for DMV stuff.
Yeah.
So what I was trying to say is I don't know what the equivalent of that
is
was for
the sex
education. So little caveat here is I don't claim to be an expert at anything really aside from being a fan of Red Sox baseball. And
how did that happen, by the way? You're from California, right?
Yeah, that's a whole nother story. But that's part of the dad thing, I guess, is I loved rooting against my dad.
Got it.
And he was a hometown person. And so when he rooted for the Lakers, I rooted for the Celtics.
Yep. My dad being close to New Haven. New Haven's kind of along the tray line. You could take the Metro North right into the city. So he became a big Yankee fan. And it was one thing we really bonded over in our life. There are two things. It was sports sports and movies, I think, are two things that really connected me to my father. And he would just take me. He knew I loved film early on. And he would just grab me. And not only would we have that time on the way to the movies, before the movies, you know, when we're sitting there, where he would just, you know, kind of, that was when we got to talk, but also movies always acted as a kind of a platform for discussion. Whereas, you know, some of the weightier movies we would see or things would happen that would cause me to ask questions or him to ask a question of me about where I'm at. And I am already seeing this with my daughter. We watch films and she's like, Daddy, what about that? What about that? And there's some power in film in that way. And that's something that's kind of like moving on down through, you know, my father to me, to my daughter. It's kind of a cool tool.
Yeah. I think there's so much to the arts and all of that that enables, and like you said, like can make so many conversations happen and can bring up great subjects that maybe would never come up and maybe aren't really important to come up or anything like that, but can help you have that deeper understanding of one another. And
yep.
any of that discussion, especially with, I mean, think back to when you were a kid and doing that with your dad, like all of that is for good.
Yeah.
even if it is, even if the only thing that is coming out of it is the memory that it creates for you later, like even if you're not reinventing the wheel or deciding how you're going to judge or not judge people by their religion or color, like even if it is a talk that's coming out of Ernest Goes to Camp.
Yep. Yep.
There is a positive from that, not only from just the experience that you are sharing together, but that conversation afterwards that, you know, for me, my dad passed away a long time ago, and any of those conversations that I can recall are like golden, obviously, yeah, to me. So
yeah, those are cherished things you keep in your back pocket that always be with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So yeah, that's great that you are tacking that along. So tell me where you are with your dad now. I don't think we've ever discussed that.
Pretty good place. We, you know what? Something pretty serious happened there. About 2 years ago, he almost passed. He was jogging. They have a place, and they do their, him and my mother do their winters in Orlando, Florida, near where my little brother lives. And then they do their summers in Cape Cod, where we always summered at Falmouth, Massachusetts. Hmm. So he's a jogger. He's always been a runner. And he was jogging, has a heart attack while he's running, and he falls to the ground. I can't even imagine what my mother is experiencing right there when he's on the ground. And he's literally passing. And perchance, someone who works for, I think it's like the Cape Cod Ecological Group or some sort of environmentalist company that they have over in Falmouth, Massachusetts, is driving by with his truck. He stops and sees my father on the ground, and he happens to have with him a defibrillator.
Oh my, you are
wait,
got to be kidding.
Wait. You think that's crazy? He has that defibrillator with him because he got it that day. That day he got that defibrillator. He's part of the family now. His name's Chuck. He's our guy. He's become part of the family. He got it that day because his father passed from a heart attack. And they were at a place where they should have had a defibrillator. Something happened in his life, and I can't speak on the specifics, where it was so important for him to have one in his truck. So he like kept pushing his boss. He's like, I'm sick of driving around without a defibrillator. This is like not cool. It just meant something to him. And so that morning, it finally happened where he was given the defibrillator. And so he's driving by and sees someone on the side of the road down, is able to use it on him, buy time for the paramedics to come. And I mean, things weren't good then. Me and my siblings sat with my father for 2 days and in a coma, and while they froze him and whole thing. And it was messed up. So many people were coming, so much family is coming by, and their mindset is they're coming to say like almost goodbye to him.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm like, and there's certain people who are saying things like of that ilk, like almost like, yeah, your father was, and like, what, and I'm like, you know, get out of here. He's going to be fine. Yeah. Like he's, you know, like there's not one, you know, that was, you know, that angsty teenage kid came out again, but we sat with him for a couple of days, and he came around from the whole thing, and it was wild, and just one of those experiences that, like, you know, we were good anyways at that point. You know, like I said, I came around and was able to, you know, get past those years where there was divisiveness and everything like that. But especially now, something like that definitely makes you realize, and made the whole family realize, you know, it could be gone at any moment. And especially we found out pretty quick how bad heart disease runs in the family. I mean, his heart now is like it's like a machine. There's, I mean, the amount of stents and pains and, pacemaker, whatever, it's all in there. And so, you know,
it is a machine.
It's a machine. It's a whole machine right now. So, you know, you just don't take anything for granted. And not that you should anyways, but I mean, something like that will definitely heighten.
Yeah. That slaps you in the face.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, we're in an awesome place. He's, like I said earlier, couldn't be more fortunate with the, parental situation at this point, and that they're, you know, lucky they're still here.
Yeah, that is a crazy story.
It's nuts. Chuck, thank you. I don't know. I'll have to send you the link to this, but we still can't get over. We actually got the opportunity to nominate him for the American Heart Association Award, and there was an event one night, and just, you know, we've got to give him praise due in many ways, which has been awesome.
That's cool. Yeah. I'm sure that was a huge moment in his life, especially with what had happened in his own life. That's
absolutely. He can't get over. You can tell he still can't get over it, because he doesn't, you know, even as a religious man. And I think this kind of confused him a little bit, because he doesn't remember anything when he was out. And I think someone who is ultra religious would obviously be confused about the fact that they didn't have any, like, he did kind of pass. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had to be brought back, and he doesn't have any of those, you know, those wondrous
tunnel story.
Yes, he doesn't have. He will look at you blankly. He's like, I don't remember anything till I came through into that hospital, and, you know, all four of his kids and his wife were standing there like, He's like, he has nothing there. And it's so surreal to him, because then he has to think about what his wife went through that day, or mm-hmm. what, you know, there was one night, you know, we all took turns, but there was one night where I just sat with him all night and held his hand throughout the entire night. And one night my sister stayed with him all night. And he just thinks about those times. It's like what that must have, shows what type of person he is, that he's thinking about that, but he was thinking about what we went through. And, and he just, he keeps apologizing about is heart disease now. He's like, oh man, he's like, I'm pretty sure I gave you a bum heart. Like,
so sorry.
Yeah, so sorry about that. And it's funny, but true.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal. I'm glad he obviously, I mean, goes without saying, but I'm glad that he pulled through that. I'm sure that must have been a massive eye opener and wrapped in very traumatic experience, but something, yeah, kind of like what we were talking about before, like it gives you that opportunity to turn anything that you needed to turn around. It's like, okay, now I'm moving forward in this different direction with a totally different mindset because of X, Y, and Z.
It took like a year or so afterwards, but I was a pretty hardcore cigarette smoker at the point. And it was something like that. I was just like, this can't go. Like I said, it's an aside. It just, something else. The bigger things were not taking relationships and, you know, especially from family relationships for granted. But like, I was just like, that had to go. And so the minute I made that decision based on this experience, it was kind of easy. Like this, this just can't be around me. And which is something that could be life-saving in its own right. And also, you know, keeps me around longer for the little lady in my life, that little 7-year-old, you know, I mean, she can't have someone, you know, in her life who's doing something that's, you know, could take her away.
Yeah, that's for me, my biggest vice, I guess, is that I just am not fit. Like I don't exercise, I don't work out, I don't do that kind of stuff. And that has been weighing a lot more heavily on me for the others in my life.
Yeah.
Really, like,
it almost becomes a responsibility, not just to yourself.
Totally.
But it's funny. I remember me and Evan were talking the other night after a taping of God, me and Evan, and we got deep into climate change. And, you know, I'm deeply political and I'm not an activist. I won't use that word because I respect hardcore activists too much, but, you know, I'm out there. But we were talking about climate change and how it affects our kids, and, you know, kind of everything kept tumbling to, you know, what our responsibility is to our children. And I remember, like, towards the end of the conversation, I'm like, man, I'm starting to find it so exhausting. Like, because, like, before I had a child, I could have, as this might sound morose, but I don't mean it that morose, like, I could have disappeared and, like, it wouldn't have mattered as much. I mean, I'm sure it would matter to people, but, like,
to some people, yeah.
But, like, to this one being right now, this, my daughter, like, it would mean the world. I need to, and I was like, I'm like, man, this is exhausting, Evan. This is exhausting to think about, but like, I need to stick around as long as I can for her, because like, it's, I know I know how much she loves me, and I know how much she wants me around. And, you know, it's just, there is that responsibility. So when are you going to start running, Tim?
Oh, God. It starts with walking.
Elliptical. One word. Yeah, elliptical.
Yeah, that's what my wife, every once in a while, will look up ads for like a rowing machine,
yeah,
or an elliptical machine or something that we can just throw in the garage and get me doing stuff.
Well, you know what? That's the thing, though. You have to find what works for you. There is totally something that's going to work for you. No question about it. You just find,
oh, yeah,
you know, sounds like walking's working for you now, and that is something.
So let's go to where that is for that little girl of yours. I know now that she was born 7 years ago, but
she was.
Tell us a little bit about that.
She was born in New York. She is, as cliche as it said, the apple of this man's eye. Mm-hmm. You know what I realized right away? I was thinking a lot today about a lot of things, but before coming on here, this is the power that Daddy Unscripted has. You have your guests thinking about life before they come on.
I love it.
And I think that's awesome. I just learned so quickly how much of a maniac I could be when you care about something. So when she was born, her lip was quivering when mm-hmm. she came out. And I forget exactly what that could mean. But in the hospital, they were like, you know, they took her and had to, they're like, we need to take her up. I actually was looking it up today. I just ran out of time to find out exactly what they were concerned about. It was a valid concern. So when she was taken away, I mean, obviously I had all these ideas of like when she was first born, and so did her mother. And we wanted to, you know, have her there and hold her and skin to skin, the whole thing. That's like, but we also wanted her to be healthy. And so at first we're like, yes, do whatever you want. And then some time went by and I'm waiting. And then I'm like the craziness kicked in immediately. And I'm just like, no, this is not okay. And so like I, you know, kind of stormed out, found out where she was, and I found myself kind of yelling at these probably wonderful nurses, the undoubtedly wonderful nurses, and just like, no, like give me my child back. She's right there. Like, and she's yeah. amongst all these other kids, and they had to kind of warm her up or something. And I think back about it now, like in that moment, I can almost understand all these crazy clips you see of like crazy dads at like a soccer game where like their son gets checked or something or gets hit, like when they get out of the field or yelling at the coach. Like, you just realize that right away I would do anything for her. And like, it just seemed, it was so surreal to kind of come to grips of like, it was like your heart's ripped out of your body, and that heart becomes this living, breathing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, I've always been kind of like cool in like the mellow sort of way, laid back and, you know, kind of rolls with the punches until that moment when I would have done anything just to like steal her back and make sure that, you know, we can hold her in her first moments of life. And it was a surreal experience right off the bat.
Yeah. That will tack on as if you really needed it. That extra kick of like, this is your child, and what will you do to protect? That would be an interesting like hospital, not scam, but like this extra ploy of tactics to determine how strong-willed parents yeah. are, like do some kind of funky test like
take
that.
Take him away for a little okay. bit. See the reaction. That's
yep.
a messed up
yep.
fatherly sort of punked, yes, like seriously. Like Ashton Kutcher like coming in and taking the, oh, we were just kidding. Here's your kid back.
Yep. We just wanted to make sure that you really want yeah. your child, and you are going to have some lawyers calling you later today, but you do get to take your child home in a couple of weeks after your incarceration.
I love that idea. If you didn't care that they took it right away, yeah. you're like, oh, whatever. Like, you don't get your kid. Like, yeah, we give it up for adoption.
Yeah, we're actually, as soon as this next dad gets done with his prison term for what he did when we took his child away, we're giving him your child as a bonus.
To kind of parallel to what I was saying when almost losing my father. Yeah. There was a point when Madeline's my daughter's name, where she was around too, where I had, and this is even comparably to those couple of days where my father-in-law was gone, definitely the worst couple of days of my life where she almost passed. And I didn't even realize it at the time because things were happening so fast. Things were so kind of intense. But she had to get hospitalized. I think it was called metapneumovirus. Do you know? Have you heard that? It can be something that just causes the common cold. It's a respiratory virus that causes upper respiratory infections. It can cause severe pneumonia, usually in older people. But she got it, and it was after I had her by myself for about a week as her mother was traveling. And she was sick that week. She was okay. She was just, you know, it was just like a cold stuff. And I was having trouble hydrating her. I remember, a lot of talks with the doctor about how different ways I can hydrate her. But like by the end of the week when her mother got home, she seemed like she was good. And I had a charity event that night, and the charity event involved drinking. It was actually like this bar crawl where there was like making, I don't know. It definitely, you know, was, I was out, but it was for a good cause. And I just get a call like halfway through the evening that they were on the way to hospital. Something's very, very wrong. She can't keep liquors down. That, you know what that was though? At that point, that was a wake up call. Cause I thought like I handled things so well during the week that like you're never off duty when you have a child. Do you know what I mean? Totally. Like, it's like, I was like, look, this is, I love to talk about how it was for a good cause because it was, but I was out drinking. And so like, I'm out there, I'm finally having fun for the first time of the week. It was a hard week, but then just boom, all of a sudden I am like running to the hospital, and we get there and the doctors aren't sure really what was going on. There's like all these, like all of a sudden they're pricking her with everything. They're putting tubes in everywhere. It's just all happening so fast, and they aren't really sure what's going on, but you know, they're stabilizing her. And but for 2 days, her fevers are reaching like nightmarish places. It's just, there was one point, and I'll just never forget this, where, you know, we were pretty good. I was cuddling her during the night. She's sleeping on me, and all of a sudden something turned, and the buzzers happened in the room. And all of a sudden, all these nurses come in and they start packing us, because I was holding her, in ice. And my daughter's on me and she's screaming. She must have been 2.5, so she could speak well. Mm-hmm. She's screaming, "Daddy, where's my daddy? Where's my daddy?" And she's in my arms, and she's looking for me. Like, she's like, it's like whatever was happening in her mind was so messed up. And they're packing her, like they're packing us in ice. Like the whole like bed we were in was being packed in ice. And to make matters worse, or more kind of like intense, was we were on, they put us in a ward, a wing of the hospital that was housed terminally ill children. And we were told we couldn't leave the room no matter what, because, you know, what she had could kill anyone in there, is what they were saying. So they were walking in with full like chemical resistant suits. I don't know the names of it.
Like full hazmat.
Full hazmat. Thank you very much. Hazmat. So every time they came in, it was like these full hazmat situations coming in to see us. And even when they came in with the ice, it was like fucking, it's like ET. They're coming in with like these, like it was so, everything was so, so intense. And so, like I said, I didn't know how bad it was. Even with all that, you always think you're going to get through things, you know. Our pediatrician visited us at one point. And he's kind of a matter of fact guy. He's really intense, and I actually appreciate that he is. I like having someone who's not kind of dancing around things. Like if he needs something from us, he'll look us straight in the eye and like, "You do this." Like, you know, you've seen What About Bob? Everyone's seen What About Bob, right?
Oh yeah.
He is the spitting image and personifies Dr. Leo Martin, who is
awesome.
Richard Dreyfuss's character. I mean, they look exactly the same. It's really crazy. So he came and visited us while we were in there and saw like everything we were dealing with. And, you know, he actually went and gave advice to the doctor and, you know, kind of was on the peripheral working for us. We didn't realize how hard or what he was dealing with. But we went to see him a couple weeks later with Madeline after we got out. And fortunately, everything is okay. And he's like, I want to talk to you for a second, Mike, afterwards. And like, he like kind of got all, and he's not this type of person. He got a little like almost emotional. And he's like, I can't believe she's here. And I'm like, wait, what? And he's like, when I visited you guys in the hospital, I thought for sure from everything I knew what's going on that you were losing your daughter. And like, as bad as I knew things were, like that just like blew my mind wide open.
Oh, totally.
I was like, because if he thought that, that's like, that was, we were in depths of concern I had no idea we were at. And yeah, that like forever in that moment, those 2 days have truly haunted me in a way that just like, I realized how fast something so special can be taken from you. And it just, it's, you know, not that you need a reminder when you have a child, or you have a relationship you care about, you know, that you don't need to take for granted, but it is amazing how, you know, getting lucky in some serious situations can be that slap in the face. That, like, look what you have, man. Look what you have.
Yeah. It's, I think I'm pausing as I'm saying this, but I think currently in the way that the world is today and the way that social media and everything is today, I think none of us can ever, ever have that excuse of, wow, I didn't realize that I really needed to pay attention to the relationships of the people that I love.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're really like, it takes 5 minutes on Twitter, not even that long. It takes 30 seconds on Twitter or a couple minutes on the news or whatever for you to realize more and more today, like everything is just even that, it seems that much more fleeting and that much more craziness is around, not just like, if I'm going to poke you as a bear a little bit, not just in like global warming and all of that, like humongous big picture items, but you know, my wife, I'm really having to push her in this day to go to a concert anymore. She's got that level of fear now because of how dangerous things are. I mean, not even just to leave our, I'm not even talking about that part of leaving our kids somewhere, but for her
to be somewhere.
Yeah. I have to admit, like when we, the last couple concerts that we've been to, I've been on that kind of heightened alert. Yeah. Like look, not that I'm going to go into John McClane mode or anything, but I need to feel like I'm aware of what is going on around me, and the world is a much scarier place. So yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is. And you know, not to go off on a tangent on that, it is amazing that places I've looked to for sanity and for cathartic release, such as a movie theater, as we saw in Colorado, or as a concert venue. These are places that are just as vulnerable or even more so because they're assemblage of people. I was at a concert. I went to see the lead singer of The National and his project the night of, we had just heard of Paris, what happened in Paris that night. I roll up to the concert and there's news vans out in front and I'm, you know, kind of feeling weird about being out anyways after what's going on and going to a concert. But I was also having this moment like, you know, fuck them. They can't keep me from this.
Yeah.
But that evening, the NYPD came in and they were doing this to other venues. There was cops along the sides of the wall. And I'm not talking just a couple, almost lining the sides of the walls of the of the Bowery Ballroom, which is an institution in New York. And so you're trying to enjoy this concert. But in the mock your mind, you're thinking about how many people have lost their lives in a similar situation. You're looking at all the cops and it's just like, the world has changed and it is, and it is something, you know, but to circle back to a better place, you were saying how technology does allow you through witnessing what's going on in the world, you know, technology presents a lot of problems for parents, but it also allows us to know how lucky we are because certain people are struggling in this way or how, you know, there's so much information that tells us we should be grateful for what we have. We should be grateful for every minute, that this is all fleeting. And yeah, as scary as the idea of that's all, it is all fleeting is, it's also, it makes you stay in the moment. It makes you, makes that hug mean a little something more. It makes you, mm-hmm, makes that love, you know, a little deeper. And that's important too. And, you know, so there is a byproduct of adversity that's pretty potent and positive and kind of wonderful at times too.
Yeah, it definitely can give you that extra little invigoration to the things that you do take on and go out for in your, yeah, life, to really kind of seize them a little bit more as well.
Yeah, no question about it. It's, yeah, yeah. I don't take it all at all for granted, especially with the little lady. It's, you know, and you mentioned climate change, you know, it's a passion of mine. And I, you know, I do see there's articles written now and discussion amongst, you know, higher minds about people are not making the decision not to become parents because they're worried about the world that they would, mm-hmm, bring their kids into. And that is something I definitely understand. I definitely understand why, if you are aware of the science of climate change, which is real, and you worry about what the world can be in the next 30, 40 years, why that would give you pause.
Totally.
But I mean, on my end, you know, knowing the science as well as I do, also, there's still hope. And like, there's still, and like, I think I mentioned earlier, I have an environmental science background. I'm an arborist. I studied forestry in school. You know, it's something, the science I'm fully aware of. As bad as it is and as bleak as it is with the warming of the atmosphere and everything, like, people deal with adversity. Even some of the times when people think we can't bounce back or not, I've seen things in nature where, whether it's coral reefs or just like deforest areas of, you know, vegetation, like, nature's so powerful too, that if we do turn the tide of this, there's so much hope out there too. And so I don't think, mm-hmm, it's such a bleak end to this whole thing. And I'm going to fight to help make this world a livable place for my daughter. But at the same time, yeah, I can't imagine a world living in a world without her in it at this point. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to live in a world without her in it.
Yeah, I think that would make the quote unquote bleakness that much more, yeah, bleak.
Absolutely. You know? And I know, you know, as much as you think about what might face the younger generations, I think I've shown her enough joy. She's found enough joy in like 7 years that she would, if she had the choice, she would have wanted to be birthed into the world and wanted to be there. Yeah. And as far as my, yeah, on my end, I like I said, I couldn't imagine her not being here and what she's given to me and what I've learned through having her and our interactions is just bountiful. It's just everything to me. I remember, I want to say one more thing. There was a family friend of mine, and I was on the verge of having Madeline, and I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it was for this birthday party of these family friends. They're kind of oil guys, but they're good. They're good people, and they're from Texas. They're twins. They were having their 60th birthday together, and these guys party. So there's all these like 60-year-olds and 65-year-olds, and they're all like puffing and like kind of like partying and stuff. And I remember texting all my friends that night. I was even younger than I am now. I was like 33, and I'm texting my friends. I'm like, yo, there's life at 60. Like, these people are like, you know, like having the best time ever.
There's hope.
There's hope. But one of the guys, one of the brothers, took me aside at one point and like, you know, he wanted to talk to me about how I was feeling about, you know, having a child and everything. And I'll just never forget it. He like looked me in the eye, and he was so sincere and he was so genuine. And he's like, look, I will tell you this. And he just had one child, as I have one child now. And he's like, I don't mean to be high horsey, but to me, it would be half a life, like literally half a life, if I never had a child. He's like, what, mm-hmm, I've learned, what I've grown from, like what I've become, what I've seen, what I've experienced would be entirely half a life if that didn't happen. And he's like, I know you're nervous. I'm sure you're excited, but I know you're nervous. And this whole thing, he's like, but what's coming is really, really something special. And he's like, it's kind of get ready, not in that like buckle up, get ready, but like get excited, get
right,
excited.
Right.
Yeah. So that was special.
That's so right on. I mean, that's like, I've talked about this with friends before that it's kind of like the humans only use 10% of their brain thing or whatever. And you kind of open that up because really like you have not experienced love like you do once your child is here and nobody else, even when you have multiple kids and, you know, you said you have just your little girl and I had people tell me that before and it was kind of like, really, how's that going to be different? Like I was kind of skeptical, but it is just how much more love you can feel and experience when you have a child and everything that goes along with that, the ups and the downs of it, the protectiveness and the openness of it. But I do believe that like he was telling you that you've only lived half of your life. You've only experienced usage of so much of the love in your heart until you have your own child. And that just blows everything out of the water.
I mentioned it earlier as just like pulling your heart out of your body and that heart, that beating heart becoming a living, breathing being. Mm-hmm. That's when I see her. That's what I feel like. It's just like I need that is the most important thing. And that's crazy. That's the love you're talking about that you might not understand. I do hate to be high horsey to any sort of person who hasn't had a child because I think you can understand, you know, some deep love. But I think, you know, people who have children can really understand what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I do. It does make me giggle a little bit. The people who on Father's Day, Mother's Days, things like that post like their dog or their cat and say, I'm just like you human parents. I've got my dog and I know exactly what you feel like. And you're like, maybe not the same.
No, I might've been that guy. But I was young at that point. I mean, I had a dog that I'd love to pieces. I had her for 15 years. I got her when I first moved to Blacksburg, Virginia, and I had her all the way. I traveled with her to Massachusetts, to California, back to New York. She was like kind of my first daughter, and like I loved her to death. Mm-hmm. The day she passed was one of the hardest ever. I remember my daughter like petting her like in the elevator as my dog's dying in my arms, the whole thing. And that was like that was like my first love in that arena. But like you're saying, it just as deep as that was, and it was profound.
Oh, totally.
So real. And like, that's like, you know, there's, you can't take away that from them, but you know,
a human is a little bit different.
No offense to dogs and cats.
No offense to dogs and cats.
Or all their pets. Like, we don't want to leave out other pets. There's other iguanas. Yeah. There's like
iguanas.
Who knows? Ferrets. Yeah, people love ferrets.
Guinea pigs, whatever. Ah. Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic. This has really been like kind of like a journey of its own.
It really has.
I'm so glad we got to do this.
Thank you. I know we were planning on it for a while, and I want to say thank you because I've listened to many of your episodes, and to be along the to be a part of the collection of fathers that you have amassed and the stories that you have told and your things, it's an honor. So I really, really appreciate it, Tim. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. And that, like I say all the time, I get so much out of these episodes and out of these conversations with so many dads and even the people who are like, you know, some of my friends will ask me, oh, you're recording a podcast. Who is it with? Is it with a celebrity? Is it with an athlete or whatever? And, you know, I always tell them like it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are some people that do not have quote unquote amazing stories to tell, and they may have lived a very vanilla life or whatever, but even people who have not scaled Kilimanjaro and been dipped in the liquid hot magma of a volcano, everybody has a story to tell of
yeah.
their dad, their relationship with their dad, them being a father, and how they do that in their unique life. And all of those have merit to them. And I have learned something from every single one of my guests, and you definitely are no exception. So I'm really happy that this happened.
Fantastic. Thank you again. It means a lot to be on here, and a lot of fun, and I will be tuning in moving forward. This is great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. So before we go, where can and should people look for you at?
Oh, great. First and foremost, my Babies Besides My Daughter is Across the Margin. That is the arts and culture online magazine that I run. So it's acrossthemargin.com. And then there's the associated podcast for that, Across the Margin, the podcast, which is part of the Osiris Network, where we have some pretty weighty conversations. We talked earlier about Welcome to the Party, the film and television podcast I'm a part of, and God We Nevin. But the one that I really, you know, lean into the hardest is ATM, the podcast. It's a place where we talk to as many fascinating storytellers and artists as possible and try to explore weighty and important topics. Check that out, and then check out Welcome to the Party and God We Nevin. Just check out everything at OsirisPod.com.
Yeah. And on Twitter, you are where?
Oh, so at Across the Margin and at Mike Shizza, MikeShizza. That's my personal one. And then at Across the Margin.
So everybody, make sure you check out the great Mike Shields and all of those places. And you can subscribe and find those podcasts. So thanks again, Michael. Yep.
Thank you so much.
And that ends my conversation with Mike Shields. A big thank you to Mike again for his time and his efforts at making this happen, as well as continuing the ball rolling, because Mike actually brought me Evan Kaufman, who I had on previously, and now I have finally recorded with Mike, and then you'll just all have to wait and see where it goes from there. All those little tendrils that come out from my guests, which is what keeps the ball rolling and makes this work so well. So again, I would encourage you guys to let me know of any guests you want me to have on, whether that's you as a dad, whether it's your dad, whether it's the guy you work with who is a dad, or whatever it may be. So you can send me those notes either at daddyunscripted@gmail.com, or you can link up with me on social media. It's Daddy Unscripted, whether it's on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And you can also find daddyunscripted.com, where the actual site is. And if you go back there, there's some really old blog posts before this was even a podcast, which is kind of cool. Oh, and I should say really quickly, I want to make sure that you guys are aware there is a companion piece post on daddyunscripted.com that has some additional photos and some additional writings and information about and by Michael. So I really want to make sure that you guys know that's there. Go to daddyunscripted.com and find that and read a little bit more of Michael's work and about what all of the different things that he does. I would also love for you guys to, if you haven't yet, go back in and subscribe to the podcast so you get all the episodes as they are released. I'm trying to be a lot more diligent with releasing an episode every 2 to 3 weeks. So far, so good. So make sure that you guys are totally open to helping with that process. You guys so far have brought me some really cool guests, so I do absolutely appreciate that. And as I always say, big thanks to Umphreys McGee again for allowing this music that you're kind of hearing in the background, but you've also heard in other parts of the podcast. This is all Umphreys McGee. So check them out at umphreys.com. And I've told you all the different places that you can check out podcasts, but make sure that you do check out osirispod.com to find not only all of the podcasts that Michael is involved with, and learn more about those, but all of the other podcasts that are on there. There's so many really good ones. So make sure you go to osirispod.com to check those out. And again, Osiris Podcast Network is partnered with Relics Magazine. So make sure you check relics.com for the music news that you need in your life. And I will tell you now, as I welcomed all of you in French, I will now bid you adieu, which I'm actually going to do by saying bonjourne, which is have a nice day. Have a great day, everybody. Sincerely, I mean that. And welcome to the new year. May 2019 be awesome for all of us. And keep your eye out for the next episode, which should be coming out within the next 2 weeks or so. Thanks, everyone.